Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Larry Miller is speaking on New Testament sexual ethics for today. So let's listen in on Larry Miller.
I have based the class on Bible study and this book by Bill Countryman called Dirt, Greed, and Sex. How's that for a catchy title? There are copies in the bookstore. They're paperback. And I've taught this class now three times, and the more I get into his book, the more helpful I find it. First of all, because he is a very careful and thorough New Testament scholar, and he's also an Episcopal priest. So he's someone who not only is dealing with the text as a scholar, but as a person of faith. All of the classes up till now have been classes in which I have tried to help us understand that we can't just open the Bible and read pieces of it without understanding the context and the culture. And the two aspects of the culture of the time in which the Levitical laws were written, which was around 6th century before Christ, and then into the time of Jesus in the 1st century, two of the basic principles that we find that determine the ethics that come from the Bible are purity ethics and property ethics. And both of those, the purity and the property, have had their major influence on what the family looked like in that time and on how people's relationship to God and their spiritual and religious life were shaped. I'm going to say just a tiny bit about purity for those of you who haven't been in the class before. You probably are somewhat familiar with the purity law from Leviticus. And we know even today there are people who practice Orthodox Judaism who have prescribed rituals and ways of preparing and eating food. That has its roots in the Torah and in Leviticus. Purity, although we do not practice observing purity in the same way as those ancient Israelites and as Jewish people do today, we do still have purity concerns in our culture. And as we've talked about, a lot of times those purity concerns have to do with sex. And if you think about the language we use to talk about sex, we have dirty films and dirty books, and there's someone who's got a filthy mind. And so our language reflects some of that purity concern having to do with sex. Purity is not only involving sex in our culture, but I would say that's probably the primary place that we can see it today. Yesterday's topic was on the family, and what I outlined was the way a family looked in ancient Israel up until the time of Jesus. And probably the biggest distinction that we have from today is that the patriarch, the male, was the head of the family, and that the wife in Jesus' time was property. Before that time, there were wives, so the wives were property. If a man was rich enough, he would have more than one wife, and maybe he would have some concubines and slaves, and that both the wives and the children were property. And another very big difference is in that time, the individual did not exist as we have individuals today. That you were part of a family and part of a large household and tribe. And so that's where when we go back and we read Jesus' words that challenge the family, he wasn't just talking about nuclear families we have today. He was basically challenging the whole system and structure of the patriarchy that had this hierarchy of the male head of the household and the wives and the children and the slaves. And you'll see some of that reflected later in the writings of Paul, continuing this challenge. the scripture of the first shall be last and the last first, I think takes on a whole fresh meaning when you realize that that was a direct challenge to the people who were hearing it. And when you look at how Jesus called his disciples, leaving the dead to bury the dead, and in Luke, hating your father and mother. So, and I on that, someone yesterday brought up a good question of why is the word hate there? And I don't have, because, you know, it's like we can understand separating from mother and father to follow Christ. But it was, we discussed yesterday the possibility that maybe hate means something like willing yourself strongly to separate. And so probably hate, like love, may have had a different meaning in that time in the language. That's just sort of a background, and I please ask you to ask me questions or interrupt if something isn't clear. And for people who've hung in there and been here the whole time and have really given some thought about purity and property, I invite you, if you think of something that you want to add to the conversation, please speak up. I would like to just say a little bit about how we can do ethics from the New Testament today. And I, like Bill Countryman, I believe that we cannot have a helpful sexual ethic for today if we read the Bible in its simplest and least adapted sense. By that I mean, it's work. It's work because it means uncovering what it meant at the time as best we can and with humility, knowing no matter how hard we try, we're never going to quite get it. It's not to say I believe that there is a very challenging sexual ethic for us today in the Bible, but that it's not something that we come at easily, and it's not something that we're going to be able to just open the Bible, read, and say, oh, that fits me. This is my ethic, and that's the ethic that should be for the world, too. I think we have to really be harder working and more humble about it. One of the gifts that we have in the Bible is that because we have these ancient scriptures from a time that has been so different and so removed in space, time, and experience, we have a witness in the Bible of standing outside our own culture and reminding us that life isn't just the way we experience it right now. It is a way of being able to stand outside our own culture and critiquing where we are if we can really understand that we've got this other view of how life and family and relationship to God can be. I think the responsible and honest Christian response in ethics and the Bible is to seek, with the help of the past, to understand what the word and the good news was for that time, and then to find in our experience today what would be the equivalent experience or understanding or challenge for today. Does that make sense? Is that okay? I think this is probably not unfamiliar, but it's important in laying out the groundwork. Another important thing that I think is really helpful is that Jesus' teaching and Paul's writing, and I think the point for biblical study and ethics as a community of faith, is transformation and not just developing theological systems. And that's, believe me, after having been in school, I figure, let's see if I add it up. I don't know. A lot of years of school, college, and then two different graduate degrees. Most of the emphasis in all of that study is on building theology, and it's important to do that, but I've discovered that it's really important, even more important, to know how the Word changes me and what am I being called to. And that is what I think a responsible ethic is about also, is letting the gospel speak to us and to change us. One of the things I talked about yesterday was that in Jesus reversing the hierarchy and saying the first shall be last and the last first, for example, using the image of a child as being, unless you're like a child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The child was pretty low on the hierarchy, right next to the slaves. And so putting a child as a model and not elevating the patriarch was a radical reversal. And I think what Jesus challenging of the way that family structure was and the way the hierarchical system was, that it was breaking down the self-sufficiency of the people, and it was basically reminding them and challenging them to make their relationship with God the center. It was challenging the conventional wisdom of the time. We talked a little bit about the parable of the prodigal son and how for the hearers of that story, they probably would have thought the father was pretty foolish to have given the younger son the inheritance. And in fact, the younger son demanding that was basically saying, Dad, why don't you kick off and let me have my money now? And the father's response, both in giving the inheritance and then in welcoming his son in return, were crazy for the people of the time. And a direct challenge to the stable, self-sufficient system that the people had. And I invite all of us today as I'm not going to lecture the whole time. This is the time we get to talk about it. But before we do that, and as we do it, I invite all of us to think about what are those stable, self-sufficient institutions that we have today that would be challenged if we were to hear such a radical word. If we were to hear the first shall be last and the last first in a really fresh way, what might the gospel be calling us to examine and possibly be shaken up and let go of? I have listed here some principles, and I've taken this from Bill Countryman's book, and I've listed the title there. He's, after three-fourths of the book, or five-sixths, laying out this whole ethic of purity and property, he comes up at the end of the book with some suggested ethical principles for today. And these are not the only ethical principles, but I think he's done a pretty thorough job laying them out, and I'd just like to go through these. First of all, membership in the Christian community is in no way based on purity. A couple days ago, we looked at Jesus' sayings in all of the Gospels. And even though there was some diversity among how Jesus presents the stories and sayings, that basically the whole system of purity, which involved knowing who was clean and unclean, and sacrificing and purifying, all of that was undermined by Jesus' teaching. The easiest summary of that is he hung out with the unclean people, knowing that the religious leaders would see him as unclean and suspect. And so, basically, if we are going to take seriously an ethic based on the gospel, we cannot live membership based on purity concerns. Today, In the ancient times, children and women were property of the patriarch. Today, I think we have to consider sexual property belongs to each person. And that if we look at the New Testament, Jesus' teaching and the writings of Paul, one of the grave sins in the New Testament is coveting the sexual property of another person. It's actually in Leviticus too. Don't covet your neighbor's house or ox or ass or wife. In the New Testament, Jesus again addresses not lusting and looking, coveting another person's wife, or even wishing that in the heart, not only doing it, but not coveting. So if we extend the idea of property today, we have to realize that sexual property belongs to the individual. I think today, we had a discussion a few nights ago on the forum about the passage of Ephesians, and I think for today, we have to recognize that the gospel can discern no inequality between men and women as they stand before God's grace. One thing that didn't really come up in the discussion Thursday night was Jesus. A major thing that Jesus did to reverse the hierarchy of the family in his teachings was to say that no longer can a man divorce his wife. And in essence, he was saying a man does not own the wife, but the man and the wife, husband and wife, own each other. Now, if you look at the time, the wife could not divorce the husband, and the husband could divorce the wife for many, many reasons. And in the process of divorce, the wife could have been left in a very dire situation. If she still had her family of origin, she could go back to them. But if she didn't, she could be pretty much outside of things with no stable financial basis. What Jesus did in saying the Mosaic law says you can divorce your wife, Jesus says no, that is no longer what you should do. And he goes all the way back to Genesis and talks about God creating humanity, male and female, and in elevating that passage of the created good of man and woman, Jesus shows that men and women are equal there and should belong to each other. He doesn't address all the other areas of women. He doesn't say women should have equal pay, women should have equal rights. You know, and I think there's a temptation now for feminists to go, Jesus was a feminist. I've heard that. I don't think that was necessarily true. But I do think that in this issue of divorce, he equalized the standing. And then Paul picked that up later in places and said, in Christ there is no slave or no Gentile, no Jew, no slave, no free, nor male, nor female. And that in terms of religious standing before God, here's equality. And I have to say, I know these are hard things. One of the things I hope we'll talk about, I think the passage on divorce is hard because if you just lift it right out, there's a problem for people in the church today because there's a lot of divorced people. And we've accepted that. I think if you understand what the situation of divorce was, you have a better understanding of it. And I think we're more inclined to want to understand that than we are other passages that trouble us and what we aren't used to. And this is another challenging one. When Jesus talks about being created in God's image, male and female, and along with this idea of man and woman owning each other, basically he says that there's a creation of union of flesh, and that normally it's only indissoluble except by death. And again, that's a challenging and a tricky one, because I believe there are situations in marriages that should be dissolved. For example, a situation where there's repeated physical abuse, that maybe what we need to look at then is, what was that a true marriage? Was that ever truly a union of flesh in the sense that God meant, or Jesus meant, for there to be a marriage? No one's saying anything. I'm expecting something. This final one is another, a meaty one, and Bill Countryman just tosses these things out, and he explains them a little bit, but I find that I'm still trying to figure out what it means. But in this one, that the Christian sexual life and property is always subordinate to God's calling, I think what he means by that is that however we are called to live our sexual lives and being ourselves, that the focus should always be on every aspect of our life, living out God's reign in our lives, living as children of God. And in other words, sex is good, and creation, as God has created us, male and female, is good. But we are not to let any part of our lives, including our sexual lives, become such the focus that we are somehow shutting ourselves from God's call. And what came popped into my mind would be the person who is so concerned in his or her sexual gratification that he might or she might use other people, and that that would not be living as God calls us. So these are the basic principles. They're broad strokes. They have a lot of specific issues around them. And I'd like to have some time now to discuss issues that you may have thought of as I've been talking or during this week. And also, I have handed out these newspaper articles. For the last year, my husband and I have been noticing articles in newspapers and magazines that we thought touched on purity or property issues, and that those are just our ideas. You may or may not agree. But does anyone want? I'll just pass these. I don't think there's enough for everyone. But if you would like a copy, just take one. And actually, I've got another here. Okay. So any.
At the time of Jesus, was the polygamy out then?
It was pretty much, I think it may have happened sometimes, but at that time, the Roman world did not practice polygamy either. And so the Jewish custom had basically become monogamous. It's a good question. So any questions or things you want to talk about?
When you say we all have own sex, then is it okay to be unfaithful, or is it okay not to be married?
I think that's a good question. Well, first of all, there's the principle, the final principle, about however we express and live our lives sexually, that it is subordinate to living as God's children. Therefore, having sex outside of marriage that is not respectful or respecting someone else's humanity would clearly be not ethical. For me, the most powerful significance of owning one's own sexual property would be the violation of that. For example, rape. I mean, that's stealing someone else. And in the ancient times, stealing someone's sexual property would be a man sleeping with his neighbor's wife. And that was stealing the other man's property. But today, it would be forcing sexual goods from someone else. And so I think that's the clearest violation of that. Someone else want to jump in here?
But if you single, then you can go on M6 so it'll be there.
Well, I think that's one of the thorny questions. That actually goes to the question of one flesh. What does it mean to have one flesh? If you sleep with a person, does the act of sexual intercourse mean that you are now one flesh forever? And sleeping with someone else is violating that? Bill Countryman, and I will say, the very last chapter, he addresses all of these things, and he does it with a lot of humility. And so I'm going to follow in his tradition and say, this is what I think. But I think that sometimes people sleep together, and it is not that intention for union of flesh. And perhaps that... I'm more concerned with people who get married because they've slept together once and do not have a significant relationship ready for marriage and then live many years or maybe the rest of their lives yoked and not being themselves and not participating in the world and loving as they should. I'm sort of skirting around your question, but I mean, I think there's a balance or there's a long range between finding that relationship that is as is intended, a loving model of mutual respect and epitome of creation and being together and just physically sleeping together, and that we're probably intended to be moving toward this union of flesh that is very whole, but that being in our society, we don't always find this ideal place right off, and there's going to be some tries and failures and things on the way. One of the articles that I've given you is an article, actually there are two articles, about a movement started about a year and a half ago among teenagers, and I forget where.
In the southeast.
They're taking a pledge for purity, and they're basically promising that they will not have sex until they get married. And that it's a very powerful pledge. They wear rings on dates, and that it's really caught on for some young people. And in part because it's been so open and so much pressure among their peers that they're really grateful to have this really firm yes or no approach. I'm not against that. I also think of the reality of how many single people there are who aren't teenagers and who are mature and in relationships that are loving and committed but haven't yet gotten married. And one other thing too, I think this is very interesting. It was not until the latter Middle Ages that priests blessed marriages. That until that time in Western civilization, marriages were common law, pretty much like you have in California today and other places, and in Texas. Priests did not you didn't go to a church and have a priest say a blessing. It was a marriage like we saw in ancient Israel, was sort of there was love involved, but it was also practical, civil joining of goods and being a household. And that the priest began to officiate. And I think it's very interesting that now our expectation is so opposite of that. And so, I don't know if I've answered your question at all, but I probably at least said something, make someone else want to say something.
Could I tell just a short story that I think raises some interesting questions around sexuality and some friends of mine in my congregation in Seattle related this to me. They have a neighbor, a man who I judge is probably in his 70s, and his wife developed Alzheimer's, and eventually he had to place her in a home because it was just too much for him to be able to care for her. And it had been an immense strain, but he was faithful to her and caring for her during this time, and it was a very lonely life for him. And well past the time when she even recognized who he was, but he still faithfully attended to her home, he developed a relationship with a woman about his age, and they spent a lot of time together and were sexual together. So was he being unfaithful to his wife? Was he being faithful to his wife, given her medical condition, but also entitled to be renewed and restored with the relationship that he had with this woman that came into his life, who understood his commitments to his wife and supported his continuing presence with his wife in the way that he could be present to her.
What do you think?
It's a very complicated world. As you talked about someone with severe Alzheimer's who's since lost all human capability, had a mother who came very soon. I know the comment on her grandchildren. This place. His family's not here. Raise the question, what's a soul? What's who's an individual? Of course, to pass judgment on. You're talking about the pleasure of abstinence, not so soon, but I think it's a wonderful thing just to counteract. But, it deals with the whole definition. What constitutes marriage. Mm-hmm. The sexual act is one part of it, I think a very important part of it. I think young folks who are constrained to a single relationship with one person to spend their life have something special.
One of the probably most controversial or interesting insights or suggestions that Bill Countryman makes is when you ask the question, what constitutes a marriage? He suggests that we tend to get married too fast in a lot of cases, and that maybe really a marriage, a true marriage in the sense of this sort of, this ideal does not happen until a couple has actually been together, living, as we would say, married for a while. And that rather than celebrating with the priest's blessing or minister's blessing at the beginning, that maybe what you really need is to wait 5 or 10 years. And when they have demonstrated in their relationship to each other and to the world that this is a union, this is loving and respectful and life producing, at that point the minister can honestly say with confidence, God's blessing on this union. And I have to say, as a pastor, I've done weddings for people that who want me to do the wedding that I've never met before. And I counsel with them 3 or 4 times, and I try to talk about, you know, address all the basic things that could possibly be in conflict. But even the ones that I enjoy meeting with and feel hopeful for, I don't know. There's really no way of telling. And if I'm standing up there as a representative of God and giving a blessing to this, I have to really think about.
But is it necessary for you to know? Because it's their union. You're just an officiator.
Well, I mean, that's the reality. That's what I have to accept. And that's a good point. But I like the idea of really recognizing that maybe the true marriage is something that is really happening when the commitment has already happened and been acted upon.
You know, there's a distinction between making love and love. I think when we first see each other, fresh romantic love, aha, across the crowded room, he is the only man in the world for me. It's wonderful, it's delightful, it's exciting. But what endures and what grows becomes loving. And I think sometimes we make that distinction. We say they slept together, they were making love, and then we go on to loving, which is a more enduring thing, which encompasses romantic love and excitement. And when we say it goes, we're excited each year about the match. But there is so much sharing together, pen and journal. So there's no way, as we stand as pastors giving blessings on a marriage, to know if it's going to turn into love.
You can pray for it and support it in the community as best you can.
I just had a comment a while back. First, just an aside in terms of the, you know, the civil blessing in Mexico until now, I think it's beginning to change now. I mean, basically, no clergy can officiate at a marriage in terms of making it legal. Now the government's beginning to give clergy a bit more of a role, but until the late 80s, you know, clergy were precluded from lots of stuff, including some basic civil rights of their own. But certainly not having a role in terms of the blessing of the marriage, in terms of making it. And I guess it's been a while since I've read Countrymen, but I, you know, the sense that I have of that, you know, just to kind of add to what you were saying, is that I think it's the basis for a far more rigorous sexual ethic than what we've typically tended to operate with, because it really needs some real discernment of, now, what is at stake here, and not just say, well, we're married, therefore it's okay. And so it's much more getting into the substance of what a sexual ethic might be. And therefore, I think is, and he's a New Testament scholar, so this is no surprise, really getting back to what I think was going on with Paul, was to say, okay, by the temple of the Spirit, and then, you know, trying to think through the specific situations of his day, and especially the 5th through 7th chapters of 1 Corinthians. Mm-hmm. And so there was a process there of discernment and, you know, trying to provide some pastoral guidance, you know, in a very given context there, that I think is a model for what a New Testament sexual ethic is about. It's far more rigorous than I think some of the rather flip things we can say about what a biblical sexual ethic is.
In some ways, our basic sexual ethic has been any sex outside of marriage is wrong. And that's it. That's the sexual ethic. And that is not very deep, you know, and it has not addressed the reality of people's lives in the last 30 to 40 years. 30, 35? The Presbyterians came out with a report on sexuality a few years ago, and it was not accepted by the assembly of the people. And one of the things that I grieve about was that it was rejected, and because what grabbed me at the very beginning of the report was an anecdote about a woman whose daughter was living with someone, not married. They'd been living together for 5 or 6 years, and she went to her pastor and was really concerned because she felt her daughter was living in sin, and what could the pastor, how could he help her with this? And basically said, well, I don't have any answer for you. You know, I mean, it was just left. And I thought, how many people has this happened to, either with that issue or with something else genuine and real? And doesn't the Bible have more to it than that? I mean, which is why I really do recommend this book and spending the time. One of the things Countryman does is he does a thorough analysis of all the places in the New Testament, particularly where these family and sexuality and child and father, all those things are addressed. And I think it helps go a step further in understanding. And it is very challenging. And I have to say, I think maybe we shy away because it's so difficult.
But I don't see anything wrong with having an idea. It may not be reality. It may not be the way the world is. We're not necessarily constrained to conform to the world. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. And to say, as a very comforting absolute, as it were, say that everything, all sex outside of marriage is wrong. When Jesus was asked, is divorce good or bad? And he said, if I recall, God would not have it this way. But Moses allowed you, through the hardness of your heart, to have divorce. It seems to me like we can accept this idea of marriage outside of, I mean, sex outside of marriage is wrong, recognizing that very few can adhere to that standard, and that because of the hardness of our heart, we make allowances and show mercy and compassion on these sorts of things. But I see nothing wrong with having that as, and there again, but that is the standard to getting back to what I said about the ultimate sanctity of a lifelong monogamous relationship is a tremendously wonderful thing to experience.
Would you then also feel comfortable, or I won't say that, would you then also say that divorce is wrong because of Jesus' teaching?
I say that each situation demands careful analysis, and like so many of our choices in life, it's just a question of the lesser of two evils.
So it sounds like that the reason I asked you that question is that if our primary ethic and focus has been really just focusing on sex outside of marriage, we then overlook the one place that Jesus really does address and say, you're not to divorce each other. You own each other. And yet, I think we have accepted as a culture that there are times when divorce is the most acceptable thing because there are bad marriages. And there are, I would say that probably we also take it too lightly now. It's become so common that there are probably circumstances where the easiness of it is a challenge.
As long as it was culturally unacceptable, it was a social stigma. Mm-hmm. It was frowned upon. And
some people suffered greatly. Mm-hmm. Well, that is the problem.
Mm-hmm. You can't.
There's no way out of it.
See, I think that, and that ties back to maybe the marriage should never have happened, you know, and that when the only ethic is only within marriage should there ever be sexual relationship, and that's where we leave it. then we have continuing situations where people who shouldn't be married get married. And then we have the problem, okay, and it's wrong to divorce. I mean, I don't think that we're just talking about conforming to the culture. I think we're really talking about what is the intention? What is God's intention for us as sexual human beings to be in family or not, and in relationship to one another?
We think of our culture as being universal. As a matter of fact, it's not at all. I lived in a community of Christians where marriage was almost unknown. And even though there were some problems with this, it seemed to work out fairly well. But the main thing is that it was their culture, and these are people who are mostly Catholics. This was in Nicaragua, among the poor people in Nicaragua. They considered this a custom to not be married, and the Catholic priests and nuns often sometimes chided them about. When you're not married, here you've got 15 kids and so forth. And I know that in one occasion a nun was talked about trying to teach birth control to these families because they've got so many kids and they're not married. And the mother will say, It's not God's will that we use birth control because the Pope has forbidden it. Mm-hmm. Well, then the nun says to her, the Pope also wants you to get married. But that's not our custom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have to go by local custom when you're thinking about that.
And some of what's happened is our local customs have changed dramatically. And now to the point where there's just a lot of confusion all around. I mean, there's still a cultural way, but it has shifted a lot.
Now, we believe in the United States de facto serial polygamy.
That's interesting.
What does Bill Countryman say about homosexuality?
Well, that's actually a good... What I can tell you is what Bill Countryman says about Paul and what Paul says about homosexuality. So if you're ready, I would like to just address a little bit the text in Romans, which is the place... It's important to talk about not only because it is one of the places that is seen to be most clearly a place where homosexuality is wrong, but it's also a place that's very interesting in Paul's writing. It's one of the few places where Paul uses language about purity, and he's talking about physical purity. Because up until, except for this particular place, Paul's emphasis, because he's concerned about the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles and the gospel being equally for Jews and Gentiles, he talks about purity of heart. He says, for Paul in general, nothing is unclean in and of itself. And that mostly, when you read the letters of Paul, it's about food. And that's where the big controversy, it's interesting now, the big controversy, one of the big controversies is homosexuality in the church. In Paul's day, what we have from Scripture was really more about food. Okay, and so, but there is this exception in Romans 1, 18 through 32, so if you have your Bible, you can look. This is the place where he does talk about purity in the physical sense. And what's interesting is, well, I'll just read it. Or does someone else want to read? We have Romans 1, 18 through 32. I'll jump in. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but because they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. But they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds futile in their thinking. Now, let me try one more time. They became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Okay. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, or birds, or animals, or reptiles. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity. And actually, another way of reading that, God gave them up to the desires of their hearts to impurity or uncleanness, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and to improper conduct. And they were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness. And for those of you who were here a couple of days, I talked about the Greek term pleonexia, which means greed, and not just regular greed, but the desire for wanting more than is yours. And Paul talks a lot about that. They were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, pleonexia, malice, full of envy, murder, deceit, strife, malignity. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. I'm just using that passage because, like I said, this is the one that it seems most clear against homosexuality. But what's interesting is, did you notice that list that has a whole bunch of things grouped together? It includes not only envy and murder and strife, but then gossips, slanderers, haters of God, disobedient to parents. I mean, there's a mixture here of things that to us seem very serious, and other things like gossip don't seem like they should be listed in the same list. The common theme, I think, for that whole list are sins that would disrupt the peace of the community. And it's really important to understand that about Paul, because that was his concern. He was writing to churches that were torn, particularly over who was clean and unclean. And not only food was the issue, but circumcision, where the people who followed Jesus' teaching, who were not Jewish, were they to be circumcised also? Or were there different levels of membership here? That was his concern. Now, what we have here is Paul talking about the Gentiles in the first part, saying, yes, they were ungodly, they were wicked, and the sin in the first group from, 18 through 23 is the sin of idolatry. And the list I read to you at the end about not acknowledging God and God gave them up to a base mind and improper conduct, that list of the those filled with envy, murder, strife, and deceit, and slander, and gossip, that is a listing of people who have sinned against the community and have created this disturbance. Sandwiched in the middle is the section that addresses what we call homosexuality, specifically men who gave up sleeping with women to sleep with other men, and women who gave up sleeping with men to sleep with other women. And what's very interesting is it's difficult because of the English translations that have been handed down through the years have basically said it's because the Gentiles were unclean that God and their sinning, the homosexual sinning, that God gave them up to the rest of this uncleanness. But what's very interesting is you don't, there were a lot of words that Paul could have used for sin, but the words that are used that have to do with sin are found in the first part about idolatry and are found in that final list that have to do with the social greed. But in the middle, the language that Paul uses to describe the unnatural relations is language of impurity, not sin. It's talked about as being dishonorable. It's talked about being unclean, impure, shameless, and unnatural. But it is not talked about as being sinful. What I think Bill Countryman offers in his discussion of this passage is that he was addressing a community mostly of Jewish Christians who were really concerned and divided about what it meant to be clean and who could be in the community. And what he does here is he starts off, and this is the first chapter, he starts off the letter by bringing up a topic that would have been an obvious difference between Jews and Gentiles in the community, because the Romans and Greeks were known to have sexual relationships, particularly men with boys. This was customary. When you talked about different cultures, in this time, that was an obvious difference between the way Jews behaved and the way people in Rome behaved, the Romans. What Paul did was to address this group of Jewish Christians, and he wanted to get at the issue of uncleanness and say, yes, the Gentiles are unclean, and see, we know, because this is what they do, that their behavior is unclean. And in Leviticus, where homosexual acts are addressed also is a sin of uncleanness. So Paul says, yes, they were unclean. Can I just finish? And then I'm almost done. But then when he gets to the end of all this, of saying yes, and it, so you try to imagine you're in this Jewish Christian audience, and you're listening to Paul, and he says, yes, the Gentiles are unclean, and they worshiped idols, and then they do these unnatural things, but then, therefore, you have no excuse, whoever you are, when you judge another, for in passing judgment upon him, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who do such things. Do you suppose, O man or woman, that when you judge those who do such things and yet do them yourself, you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you presume upon the riches of his kindness and forbearance and patience? Do you not know that God's kindness is meant to lead you to repentance? And it goes on. That's powerful. I mean, what Paul did was to get the Jewish Christians on his side. They're probably going, yeah, they're really unclean. And then he goes, and who are you to judge that? And I think that it was meant in terms of the uncleanliness issue. But I think if we look at what's the issue today, maybe the challenge is about homosexuality. Precisely because I think a lot of what the rage is over the issue of homosexuality is a purity issue. I've talked about that in some of the other classes. But when we tend to see things that are self-evident and we have a physical reaction, sometimes that's a purity issue.